Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I just messed around my screens and I shouldn't.
You were fiddling, weren't you?
Yeah, fiddling with
knobs and buttons, weren't you?
Hey? Yeah.
You know what happens when you do that?
Yeah, I should never be fiddling with knobs. But yeah, no, we're back for episode 6 of UK Film Club. Mm. Are you excited, Brian?
Oh, I'm always excited when we talk about films. It's one of my pet subjects, you know. It's one of my core interests. So I always love talking about films.
And we're hitting like a heavy period right now for, you know, great cinema in terms of, like, you know, the big films coming to the screens. Yeah. And there's a lot out to see, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, July, August is when the big hitters really come into play, and we've really seen that now, haven't we? But then you kind of get a lull, don't you? End of August, going into the autumn, then it picks up again. But this is when they want to get bums on seats, isn't it, really? June, July time. And they've really hit the mark, haven't they, really? If you think post-COVID, we're getting to a stage now where you feel we're back to business as usual, you know, that we're back to normal in terms of films being released and films being made. So that's always a good sign.
Yeah, it's like the studios have kind of caught up with all the backlog and now can actually start timing releases quite well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Before we get into our show, we'll just tell people what's coming up. So if this is your first time to UK Film Club, Brian is our sort of head film critic, really. He's got that title just now. That just
Cheers.
Happened.
Thanks for that.
He reviews the big cinema films and very kindly goes and watches a selection, usually about 4 or 5 of them. Mm-hmm. He will review first. Then we'll review something big on streaming. So something from the sort of heavy hitters like Netflix or Amazon Prime. Then we'll review a few indie films. And we now have people that are able to actually request a review. So if you are an indie filmmaker listening to this, you can go to ukfilmreview.co.uk/podcast. And all the details are on there on how you can enter your film so that we review it in that indie section. And then the final part of the show is where we review our nostalgia pick, which is a film from the past, really, that we just want to cover and finish up on. But before we start all that, Brian, on this show, I'm bucking the trend slightly because I put out a Twitter post, although it's called X now, isn't it? Depending on when you're listening to this, maybe it's rebranding.
Right, yeah, of course it is.
Where I talked about, I said, what's your most unconventional cinema snack? And we had a few replies, but I'd want to hear yours first, Brian. Have you ever taken anything into a screening to eat or drink that was kind of unconventional?
No, not at all. I've got into the habit now where I don't take any food into a screening. I take possibly a bottle of water. My habit always is that I graze on food, particularly when I'm watching TV. So it's a way of breaking the habit temporarily by going to the cinema and not having any food. So it's kind of like prevention being better than cure. I mean, I know I'm going to be stuffing my face when I come out, but so because of that, I don't necessarily. But I'm really curious by unconventional snacks.
Well, yeah, we had a few which was interesting. And funny enough, when me and you went to see Fast and the Furious, they put out, didn't they, some sort of free bags of popcorn.
That's right.
And neither one of us touched them.
No, I know. They didn't look all that appetizing, did they? But that's probably why they were free.
Yeah, I know. It looked like the sort of bog standard popcorn. Yeah, but it was also, I'm not a big fan of eating popcorn in the cinema. And I get a lot of guff for this because obviously it's the most sort of common snack, but it's noisy, it goes on forever, it's not you know, my daughter absolutely loves popcorn, she's obsessed with it, and just the smell of it and everything.
I'm not keen, really. I never have been, not on popcorn. It's all right, it's okay, but I understand why people feel the need to eat. But I mean, I think we need silent snacks that don't make any noise when you eat them, because you look inside any cinema foyer, what have you got? You've got the noisiest foods ever invented. Popcorn and nachos and peanuts and crisps. You know, they couldn't find anything more noisier, could they, really? But, you know, it's what people like to do, isn't it, really? And, of course, you can't expect a cinema not to sell those snacks. But it doesn't stop people. I think some cinemas, do some cinemas stop people from taking food in?
Their own food, yeah. I think they do.
Some do, don't they, I think.
Some do, and also I think there is a kind of general consensus amongst most people now that we need to be supporting the cinemas, and they do make a lot of money off the snacks and stuff.
Oh, of course
they do. Yeah. I just, you know, as a guy that has two daughters and a wife, it's like, if we go to the cinema, first off, you know, you're talking 40, 50 quid for the tickets, and then if you're buying snacks, it's like double that. And
I know,
it's like,
that's
to
right.
just go and see a film. And also, it's not like, oh, you're getting duck à l'orange. It's like you're getting these horrible junk food that is just awful. So
the thing is, you know, it's pretty basic, it's edible, but it's just something to munch on, isn't it, while you're watching a film? Because it's replicating the experience of being at home, isn't it? They want people to feel as comfortable as possible. So they supply what is basically junk, stroke, comfort food. And there's nothing wrong with that. But
have a listen to this, Brian, because actually, you know, this could buck the trend. Maybe cinemas are going to jump on this. Now, a couple of these are from writers of the site. So Darren Tilby, who's a great writer, he's written loads of stuff for us in the past. Uh-huh. He takes in a Tesco extra large whole roast chicken.
What?
A roast chicken.
You're kidding me.
Now, if you're going to feast on something, that's great, but that is pretty unconventional, and it's also pretty disturbing for anyone. It also depends on the film you're watching, right? So if you're watching something where that is going to like also affect how you experience the film, like cannibalism or anything like that, it's like, no.
Well, I admire his healthy appetite. I've got a healthy appetite, so I kind of see where he's coming from. But I mean, wow, that is unusual. I've never seen anyone take a whole chicken into a cinema or sit there with it. Yeah, no, that's...
I've seen someone eat a Nando's. They had Nando's, but I don't know if it was a whole chicken, but it was in the Nando's packet, and I thought, gosh, I can smell that.
Yeah, you can't... The smell's a good giveaway, isn't it? When you're in a fairly sort of close enclosed sort of screen as well. Yeah.
So we had Amber Jackson. If you don't know Amber, she hosts the Gay Actually podcast, and she's a great writer for the site. She took in Bao Bao buns, which, you know, I love it. I think, and also they're soft, right? So that's fine. It's not going to make much of a crunch, depending on the filling. That's quiet. Happy with that.
That's what we want. Yeah.
And then Louis Findlay, who is a filmmaker, he takes in a Boots meal deal. Now, I like how specific this was, but I am just trying to see if you sort of elaborated on what it was that he had in there. But I think, you know, those are some very interesting picks, and I'm all for it. I think if you're going to take food in, and that's fine, we don't want to stop people doing that. But I would just say to cinemas, you know, up your game, put a roast chicken there. I was going to say
they should pick up on this, shouldn't they?
They could have one of those like rotisserie things, but it's in the seat in front of you. So the person that sat in front of you has got like a little fire behind them, and you're just like turning a chicken.
Yeah. But I'll tell you what though, with particularly long films, I mean, you look at Oppenheimer, for example, it's 3 hours long, you know, and people are going to get hungry, aren't they? You know, if you make them sit still for that length of time.
You do have to really plan your snacks in a film like that as well, yeah. Because if you have anything like really sugary, because I'm a sucker for chocolate, so I'll eat like minstrels or something at the beginning, and then terrible. About 10 minutes in, I'm going to have a massive crash, which is just not good. So,
I know. Yeah. Well, when I used to eat in the cinema, it would be chocolate. But it would be something like Revels, the big sort of one of those big, maybe a couple of them.
Revels is the one where they have like the mixture of flavors.
Yeah,
like, is that like the gamble? Is there any of them that you don't like?
Well, probably the toffee ones. I'm not a big fan of toffee generally, so I might sort out the toffee ones, but the rest of them, it's fair game. You know, I wouldn't discriminate against any of the rest of them. But you see, that's the thing. I know if I grabbed a bag of those at the kiosk, they would be gone within half an hour. Really, I just can't that help doing that. So, as I say, that's why I've stopped.
That's because how you I know that control your urges is just to not have it, and then you're forced into like at least 2-3 hours of not eating.
That's right. It's abstinence, isn't it? Really, it's a bit. I'm teaching myself a bit of discipline, but not that anyone else listening out there shouldn't indulge themselves and do what they want. That's great. Yeah. But
be the best you. That's what I say. Yeah. If that involves eating a whole chicken, go for it.
Yeah, that's right.
So, and you mentioned Oppenheimer. We're not reviewing that on the show, right? That's not your list.
That's going to be next month. It kind of got released a bit too close to recording this one.
Yeah.
So we're going to save that one for next month.
Yeah, no problem. So the films for the cinema that we'll be reviewing are pretty cool. We've got some excellent movies coming up.
Yeah.
The first one is a long-awaited, what would be a fifth version of a film? It is the fifth, isn't it?
It is the fifth, yeah.
A fifthical.
All right, we'll settle on that. A
fifthical,
that kind of works.
Yeah. If you don't know the film we're talking about, it's Indiana Jones.
Stay where you are. Don't move.
Who are these people?
We need to get out of here.
Are they with you?
Not an inch, Miss Shaw. Miss Shaw, stop! Hold up! Sorry.
Helena!
Captain Jones, it's over.
Who are you people? What do you want?
Stop!
Helena Shaw!
She's on the roof. Find another way up.
Dr. Jones, we're not gonna hurt you.
Yes, it is. Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny. So this is directed by James Mangold, starring Harrison Ford, Phoebe Waller-Bridge, Mads Mikkelsen and Toby Jones. The story begins in 1945 as the Second World War is drawing to a close. Hitler has ordered his henchmen to relieve Europe of its finest artifacts. Indiana Jones is hot on the tracks alongside fellow archaeologist Basil Shaw. However, Nazi scientist Dr. Voller has discovered an artifact with terrifying power. Archimedes' dial is a time-bending device that can change the course of history. The narrative jumps forward to 1969, when Jones reunites with goddaughter Helena. She's the daughter of Basil Shaw and studying for a doctorate in archaeology. Helena is determined to track down Archimedes' dial with Jones' help, but Indy is not convinced by her motives as sinister forces begin to close in. Anyway, look, this is all great entertainment, but it does feel a bit like a greatest hits package. The stunts look familiar, set pieces are well executed, but Harrison Ford tearing around at the age of 80, Chris, I kind of worry about him, you know? Jumping on the horse and all that, you know, it's not what an 80-year-old should be doing. The most remarkable part of this film is the first 40 minutes, when AI de-ages Ford, and it works really well. They're mixing old footage from other movies, but the cracks soon appear when the story jumps forward to the 60s. He doesn't look the age he's meant to be. But Indiana Jones is still a great character, still great fun to watch. But I just feel that they've left Ford in the role for a bit too long. And it's almost like one last film for old time's sake. And I would like to see them keep the brand fresh and do what they do with James Bond, reboot the franchise by casting a new Indiana Jones. But aside from that, not the best, but not nowhere near the worst. It's good entertainment, but doesn't bear comparison to say the first two Indiana Jones films.
It's funny because I watched the Indiana Jones for the very first time a couple of years ago, was when my second daughter was born, and watched them consecutively over four nights, and I really didn't enjoy the second one. That's the one where he goes into the temple, isn't it?
Yeah, in the temple of June,
Doom. Yeah, and it got just absolutely batshit crazy, and I was like, I don't understand what's happening. Like, it was just a bit mental. Whereas I actually quite liked one and three. Four was definitely the worst. Like, that was just
unbearable. Nobody likes that. Nobody likes that one.
So is this better than four?
It's better than four, but not as good as one or three. I take your point about two, but you know, you kind of, all films polarize opinion to a certain extent, don't they? Because everyone's got a view of what's the best and what isn't. But
so what's your order then? What would, in terms of favorite to not favorite?
I think one, followed by three, followed by two, followed by five, followed by four.
Okay, well, yeah, same along with me, but yeah, I haven't seen this yet. So
yeah, pretty similar. But bear in mind how long Indiana Jones has been around. I mean, the first film came out in 1981, and I can remember being absolutely blown away by it. I loved it when it first came out. But I suppose, like yourself, you have to take account of people arriving late to the party, if you like, and seeing it years after it was first made. Because I think when you see a film that was a massive hit in the early 80s, but you see it years later, right, your expectation changes because you've seen films move forward, don't they? The technology changes. So that all comes into play. But I think it's interesting if you see a film for the first time when it first comes out, but then you see it when it's been around for maybe 20 years, you know, times change and your view of it might change. But I remember being enthralled by the first one, but it does depend. But I think, you know, the way you see different films do change as time goes on. But, you know, I think it's the fact that Harrison Ford is the age he is now, probably shouldn't be playing Indiana Jones. And I think it is kind of old time's sake, isn't it, really?
There you go. Well, you heard it here first. Brian saying that Harrison Ford needs to quit. So,
well, Indiana Jones, anyway.
Yeah.
Indiana Jones.
You know, no, don't take it back. You said you hate Harrison Ford. You want him cancelled. You just absolutely loathe him. That is not true. Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny. Yeah. So currently at cinemas, I'm not sure how long it will last, right?
Think it's still doing okay.
Yeah.
But it's possibly missed. It's probably past its peak in terms of, you know, the bums that it puts on seats and the, you know. So I think bearing in mind what came after as well.
Yeah, there's quite a lot of choice at the moment. I think it's going to take away there.
Yeah, but still there, though. Still hanging in there.
There we go. Well, we're taking a little bit of a trip back with this next one, Ziggy Stardust.
Oh, wow, yeah. I'm actually really glad that we've been able to review this film, Chris, because it's an opportunity to highlight what else the cinema can offer aside from the usual theatrical releases. This was a global premiere of Ziggy Stardust, the newly restored film of David Bowie's final outing as his legendary alter ego. For those who are unfamiliar with the character, Ziggy Stardust was Bowie's stage persona for a brief spell in the 1970s. It spawned two albums and a string of live concerts with backing band The Spiders from Mars. The evening began with a Q&A session, broadcast live from the Hammersmith Odeon, where exactly 50 years ago the gig took place. The panel was chaired by journalist Phil Alexander as they explored the genius that was David Bowie. The panel featured Suggs from Madness and Ken Scott, who produced four of Bowie's albums. That was followed by the film itself, which was beamed live by satellite across the world. So it was directed by D.A. Pennybaker and starring David Bowie, obviously, as Ziggy Stardust, backed by the Spiders from Mars, consisting of Mick Ronson on guitar, Trevor Boulder on bass and Mick Wobensee on drums. Although badged as a documentary, it's really a film of the concert. There isn't much of a narrative here. The tale of an androgynous alien rock star is told in the title song and sets the tone for a classic gig. The songs speak for themselves. All the Young Dudes, Oh You Pretty Things, Gene Genie, Changes, Space Oddity, I could go on. There's nothing particularly striking about D.A. Pennybaker's film in purely cinematic terms. The jerky handheld cameras often lose focus, and poor lighting at the Odeon doesn't help. But the sound quality is astonishing and benefits from 5.1 surround sound. Frankly, the grainy visuals let the film down, but this remains one of the greatest rock concerts ever committed to film.
Wow. That is high praise, because yes, I'm a big fan of musical biopics, and I'm a big fan of a lot of these sort of classic concert films. I remember watching the original Woodstock movie. I tell you what, we're talking about a long film. That's long. But
it does go on a bit, doesn't it? Yeah,
it's true. But it was, you know, so compelling, because it just felt like this little capsule of time that you just, you know, were being able to witness that you never would have been able to otherwise. It sounds like a bit like this, where you're sort of being able to, especially obviously because Bowie's sadly passed away, that it makes it all the more poignant that he's been captured in this moment, and, you know, and in such a powerful way, and to have. So did it get put back into a few cinemas? Is that what we're doing here?
I think it did periodically. I think listeners will need to have a dig round, because they do plan to show it again at some point, but they won't pick their moment. The reason this was done is because it was 50 years to the day. So when I saw it on the 3rd of July, it was exactly 50 years ago that the gig took place. So there was a reason for doing it then, but I think if listeners keep a close eye out, it will get periodically shown at the cinema. I mean, sorry, go on, after you.
No, I was just saying I had a look and I can't see any showtimes. Yeah. So yeah, I think you'd be very lucky to find one.
Yeah, but there, as I say, that in the Q&A, that they did mention that there was a possibility it could be shown again. So people just need to keep an eye out for it, but or else it will be streaming at some point, I'm sure. But there's always value in putting this kind of film on the big screen, because there's nothing like it, particularly with the surround sound that you get, and it gives the music new life. And someone like David Bowie, whatever your opinion is, whatever your tastes are in music, is one of the true artists who creates music of rare beauty and intelligence. And if you can see it on the big screen, please do so.
Wow. A stunning review there of film. Fantastic.
One other thing I would mention there, though, Chris, is that we can see other things that at the cinema. You can see live football, live concerts, theatre shows, ballet, classic movies. Some cinemas are showing the Women's World Cup at the moment. So there is so much you can see there. And I think we need to give that a bit of a shout, just so that people are aware and they don't forget what else they can see at the cinema.
Yeah, funny enough, I've only ever seen one opera, and I saw it at the cinema.
Which one was that then?
Yeah, I knew you were going to say that. And as soon as I told the story, and I was like, I can't remember what it was. But I what was good about the experience, I went with an old editor when I was writing for a magazine, and I was like, he said, oh, let's go and you can write it up. And I was like, you know, you feel a bit cultured. He's like, oh, I'm watching an opera.
Yeah.
But you had the safety net of being in a cinema, because it was like you weren't in a theatre, or you're worried about what you're doing or how you look, because it's all in dark and it's great.
Yeah.
And I was able to sort of immerse myself, but I did find that it's just not for me. I didn't enjoy it at that time anyway. This was going back a good 10, 12 years.
Yeah,
but,
no, I mean, yeah. Was it in Italian, the opera?
It was, yeah.
Subtitles?
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's kind of a help, but I think I'm not a huge fan of the opera, but you do get to see something in a different light when you see anything on a big screen. It looks different, it feels different. But
you're right, you know, in terms of shouting it out in what's going on. I actually didn't know they were doing the Women's World Cup, because actually that's great, because me and my daughter like to watch that.
Yeah.
So
you need to look around, though. It depends on what your local multiplex is, and you know, but it is on. You can find it.
Nice. Thank you, Brian. Okay, so that was Ziggy Stardust. Next up is Pixar's latest offering, Elemental.
Hey, Fern. How you doing?
Living the dream.
You know those citations I just gave you from Firetown?
I was about to send them to Mrs. Cumulus, then get sprayed for fungus rot.
Wait!
Tell him what you told me about your dad and letting him down?
No, that's personal.
It really got to me. He might feel it too. Her dad will be
Nope. So
no.
Super disappointed in her.
Stop it.
He might even be ashamed.
What are you doing?
But the main thing is, if her father can't retire, it will be all Ember's.
Stop talking!
Yes, right, okay. Yeah, so this is directed by Peter Sloan, starring, or I should say voiced, by Leah Lewis, Mamadou Athi, Ronnie Del Carmen, and Sheila Omni. This is the tale of outsiders trying to fit into an often hostile environment and a sense of community that grows around their own kind. A family of fire elements emigrate to Element City. Bernie Lumen works hard to build up a business. Mama Cinder raises their feisty and fiery daughter, Ember. Bernie aims to hand the business over to Ember when he retires, but she just cannot control her temper with difficult customers. Ember's heart begins to melt when she meets water element Wade Ripple, a city inspector who could cause no end of trouble for the business. But can fire and water really mix rather than coexist? What we get here is a level of consistency. Pixar will always be judged against their own body of work. And it's not one of their best, but it's good enough. The story plugs into a common theme of people learning to live together, with a good old-fashioned romance thrown into the mix. There are clever visual gags and some nice one-liners. All good, solid entertainment. But as I say, good fun. One for the family, but it does the job.
Yeah, it had that feel of it wasn't going to do too much. It felt, even just from the trailers and things, like it sort of was riffing a little bit off Inside Out and Soul, and in terms of just the way that it looked, that I thought that they're not doing anything kind of revolutionary here. It just feels like, yeah, they're making another film. And then when I started to see the reviews and it was like three stars, I was like, oh, okay, yeah, that's exactly what they've done.
I gave it 3 stars. You wouldn't give it anything less because it is very, very well done. And it's good fun to watch. But you get the sense it's a bit of a filler for Pixar. You know, it's sort of like, oh, we'll put something out now. We'll keep things ticking over before the next big project arrives. That's what it feels like. But, you know, this, as I say, there are some nice lines in it. You know, some good visual gags. And this idea of a couple, one's a fire element and one's a water element. You know, one can extinguish the other. The other one can vaporize the other. That's quite good. That's quite cute. I like that. But again, it's not a barnstormer. It's not going to be a classic. But it will do. You know, it's good fun.
It will do. That will be the title of the next Pixar film.
I've given them inspiration. I should claim something off them, shouldn't I? Really.
Right. You know. Well, I'm excited about this next one because I'm a big fan of the franchise. So we're heading over to the Tom Cruise vehicle, which is Mission Impossible. So this is what? Dead Reckoning Part 1?
Dead Reckoning Part 1.
Yep.
Oh, wow. This is the film of the year, in my
opinion.
Wow.
Film of the year.
So far.
Gosh.
I must say that. I must add that health warning so far. Directed by Christopher McQuarrie, starring Tom Cruise, Hayley Atwell, Ving Rhames, Simon Pegg, Rebecca Ferguson, and Vanessa Kirby. This is the 7th Mission Impossible film, and it is a cracker. The story begins when Ethan Hunt receives details of his latest mission. His team are charged with recovery of the key to a device powered by artificial intelligence, known as the Entity. In the wrong hands, it could have devastating consequences, with the potential to control defense systems. Not only must they recover the key, but also learn what it unlocks. Hunt is joined by right-hand man Luther Stickle and nervy technical wizard Benji Dunn. They combine with old sparring partner Ilsa Faust as they chase the key through the Middle East and Europe. The situation grows increasingly complex as pickpocket Grace is hired to steal the key for a mystery client. Sinister forces begin to close in as Alana Mitsopoulos acts as the duplicitous go-between. So, what can I say? The stunts are absolutely jaw-dropping and move at a breakneck speed. Cruise romps through the countryside on a motorbike, a bit like Steve McQueen in The Great Escape. It builds to a thrilling set piece that already has a life of its own. It's an amazing film. All the previous installments just feel anonymous in comparison. It certainly fills the void temporarily left by James Bond. I can't wait for the next part. It is brilliant. I absolutely loved it. and it's 5 stars. I would give it 6 stars if I could.
But I won't let you.
No, we can't, can we? That would breach the reviewer's code, wouldn't it, if we did?
It would. And I don't want to hear anything about these people that do out of 10 or anything like that, or out of 100 or anything like that. It's 5. Thank you very much.
Yeah, that's an easy scale to follow, though, isn't it? 1 to 5, I think.
But no, I mean, I'm a big fan of the Mission Impossible films. I think they have done really well to keep the franchise on tracks. It just seems to know how to deliver a really, really great film. Because even the first three, well, the first one is just legendary. It's really good. I think 2 and 3 are a little bit sort of like, okay, like, are they as enjoyable? But after you get, I just think they just keep getting better from there. I was like, this is great. And I think it's like you were saying earlier about films, when the industry evolves, these films seem to know how to embrace that and go, all right, now we can do a film on this level, and now we can do a film on this level. They're not trying to redo the formula, although there is that aspect, but they really do think, okay, right, what's the next craziest stunt we can do? Because now we can, you know, really get it done.
Well, you see, they do say that the next one, Dead Reckoning Part 2, will be the last Mission Impossible film. And, you know, I would be sad if that happened, but maybe it's best to sort of say, right, we draw a line under it now. We can't do any better than we've already done. Leave the punters wanting more. You know, in some ways you crave more, but you don't want more. You know, I think we should, as fans, as film goers, we should accept when we've seen enough of something. With Mission Impossible, they leave enough time in between releases so it stays fairly fresh. On average, there's a 2 or 3 year gap in between. And that makes sense. And I think in a way that they're filling the gap that's temporarily left by James Bond. I'll come back to that point because it is a kind of a James Bond-esque kind of story. It's the sort of film they should be making with the new Bond. But it's brilliant. That's why you go to the movies. Absolutely brilliant. You can't take your eyes off it. Tom Cruise gives you value for money every single time. You can't really, you know, he has his detractors, but from this film, I can't see why, because it is so good. It's so good. It really is.
There you go. Film of the year so far. One more from the cinema releases. It is No Hard Feelings.
So this was a late replacement. This was a substitute for Oppenheimer because I couldn't get to see Oppenheimer in time. So I thought I'd go and see this film. And it's in complete contrast to Oppenheimer, really. But it's a pleasant surprise, Chris. Directed by Gene Stupnitsky. I knew I was going to have trouble with this name. Gene Stupnitsky. I've been rehearsing this, you know. It didn't come out right. But anyway. And starring Jennifer Lawrence, Adam Barth Feldman, and a brief cameo from Matthew Broderick. So what have we got here? Manny Barker is a bed-hopping singleton with a string of one-night stands behind her. She owes property tax on her home and is struggling to pay what's owed. Maddie makes a living as an Uber driver, but her car has been repossessed. Desperate measures are required, so Maddie replies to an advert placed by the Beckers. The micromanagement of their son Percy knows no bounds and have a special assignment for her, should she choose to accept. See what I did there?
Nice.
Yeah, anyway. So, the Beckers are seeking a summer companion for Percy before he heads off to college. It soon becomes obvious that Maddie has to date Percy in every sense of the word. However, she gets the use of the family Buick for her services. It all seems like a no-brainer. She gets to drive a great car and solve her money worries all in one go. And how could he possibly resist her undoubted charms? But she hasn't bargained for Percy's sheltered upbringing. And in fact, he barely leaves his bedroom. So look, you know what the deal is here, really, and can easily predict the outcome. But the characters are so likable. Maddie comes across as a calculating woman of the world, but really has a heart of gold. Percy is the goofy kid who fails to recognise a gift horse, but is more perceptive than anyone realises. There is a surprising depth in the plot that initially seems flimsy, but is ultimately revealing. Life experience comes in many guises and proves that age doesn't always make us wiser. but a very, very nice watch. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, you said it was a good film, and I was nice that you got this in there, because obviously great to have Oppenheimer if we could, but this felt like maybe something that did need a light shined on it. I had seen a few good reviews of it out there, saying that it was funnier than they thought it was going to be. So
it surprises you. What I think is, I find baffling though, Chris, is that the timing of release, to release it at the beginning of July when they're up against four absolutely massive films, Indiana Jones, Mission Impossible, Oppenheimer, and Barbie as well. That, you know, I can't understand why they released it now, because it is going to get buried. This type of film will do up against big beasts like that. You know, if they'd waited for a month or two, early autumn, you know, it would have done a lot better. But like many others, I was really surprised by how much I enjoyed it. Very, very good watch. Really nice film.
There you go. No hard feelings. And that's the end of the cinema releases. So we're going to move swiftly on to a film that came out on Netflix this month, July, if you're listening, which was a sequel to the Bird Box film, Bird Box Barcelona. Mm. Had you seen the original of this, Brian?
No, I hadn't. But I'll tell you what I did, though, Chris. As soon as I saw it was already on Netflix, the first one, I had to watch that as well.
Is it worth a watch, actually? I quite like that film. I thought it was all right.
They're both very good films, and I think for concert, I mean, you don't have to watch.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
The first one.
No.
And it's not necessarily a sequel, is it, Bird Box Barcelona? Because I think it's happening in parallel with what you see in Bird Box.
Absolutely, yeah. It feels like it's like they've got this event and then they're just doing like a separate story elsewhere. Yeah.
But for Bird Box Barcelona, yeah, I really enjoyed it. I think it was a really gripping, intense film to watch. You know, the idea that this creature has somehow managed to force mass suicides is a scary concept. And it is a bit like a kind of a post-apocalyptic event. What I found slightly frustrating about it was that it didn't really explain why this has happened, how this creature attained the power that it did. Did you find that?
So I think partly with this film and with the first one, it was that they do leave things purposefully vague, I think, because they don't want to trip themselves up. They don't want to sort of get into the whole
kind of... It's deliberate.
I think with this film, which differs to the first movie, is that there's a bit more of a focus on the people that seem to be now going along with the beast or whatever it is, and then recruiting people to try and then get them to kill themselves, because it's like they've had the whole wave of everyone just doing it, and then there's all the people that have managed to survive and hold themselves up inside a house. So now you've got these this group of people who, like, one of whom is our protagonist who we're following, Sebastian, who is going into these crevices to try and root people out so that he can bring them to the light and show them this the beast, and then before they then go and kill themselves. So it's quite a dark premise, and I think the film doesn't want to sort of spend too much time on the supernatural element. It's more to do with the human element in this film of he's clearly being corrupted, and you kind of understand why as it goes along, but you kind of also, get attached to him. You get attached to his survival, and you want him to sort of make it, but you also want him to sort of redeem himself because of all the sort of bad things he's done. I mean, there's a particularly amazing scene in a bus station where I've never seen a bus go that fast, let alone inside a contained building. I thought one of the strengths of the film was that the set pieces were just relentless. That every 5-10 minutes you're getting a huge action sequence, and they really didn't spare any expense. It was just huge. It was a huge movie.
I agree. The stunts, the visuals were amazing, absolutely incredible, particularly the cable car as well. That was absolutely riveting. You couldn't take your eyes off it, and there's that kind of sense of it, of you being there as well. So the direction's very perceptive, and it puts you in the time and in the place, which is what any director needs to do. But you see it so clearly in this film.
I think it's the type of film that, like you say, you don't need to see the first one. If you do, it helps, because I think actually the first one's probably a little bit more accessible than this one. And you really get into the idea of this post-apocalyptic world quite quickly. Whenever this sort of film comes out, I always compare it to a film like A Quiet Place, which is a similarly vain film in terms of, it's a world where everything's gone to shit because...
Yeah.
In that one, you can't make a sound. And in this one, you can't look at anything. Yeah. So there's like a very simple premise there. And I think A Quiet Place is a much better film. It's delivered better. But with this, I think they know that the strength is in these action sequences. So they do kind of deliver them fairly rapidly. And you follow the protagonist from sort of one location to another. It doesn't get too bogged down in one area. It knows that it needs to move on. So I quite liked that. It wasn't without its faults. I think there were parts to it that I was like, oh, okay, that doesn't really seem like it would, that's how they would react or how they would, because I'm always questioning these things. Because, if I ever found myself in this situation, I'd be like, would I do that? I don't think I would do that.
But you see, the thing is though, with any film, you're going to think to yourself, well, what would I do then? What would I do if I was in their shoes? And that is something you go through your mind with every film you watch. You think, what would you do? And a lot of it doesn't make sense, but possibly going back to your earlier point about not explaining too much of the backstory is to keep you wondering and guessing and make you curious. But it gets to a point where you think that actually becomes quite irritating, because I think you need to portray a certain amount of logic with any storyline, with any narrative. You look at a character's motivation, and they could do things that are as outrageous as you like, but it has to maintain some grip on reality. And that's where they tread a very fine line. And that's where you start to question it more, because it is a terrifying scenario. I mean, that scenario goes further than most post-apocalyptic type films would go. I mean, look at Children of Men, for example. That film, as dire as it portrayed, as scenes that it portrayed, there was always a sense of hope there with Children of Men, that they might find a way back. But the scenario in Bird Box, Barcelona, sounds like the end, doesn't it?
Yeah, it feels like, how are they ever going to sort of survive? Yeah. And without giving away too much, sort of nearer the end, you do get an element of, they've found a way to survive.
Yeah.
But that's it. It's not like, oh, there's a cure or whatever. But maybe there is. But I think with Netflix, likelihood is they are lining up more of these films. I do think though they have to stick with the alliteration. Like every location should have to begin with B. So it's like Bird Box, Barcelona, Bird Box, Boston,
Birmingham,
Bournemouth. No, Birmingham was perfect. Bird Box, Birmingham.
I think you're right there, actually,
That's terrific. That's really good. enjoyable film. I think, it's worth your time, but it doesn't quite reach the heights of things like Children of Men, A Quiet Place, those sort of films. There are better films in this genre, it's worthy.
Yeah, those films you've just mentioned there are much better rounded. They're more complete narratives. But I think with Bird Box Barcelona, it's more limited, but a very good watch, though. Very good watch.
Cool. So that's your streaming pick for the month, and we'll be reviewing something else from my platform next month. Moving on now to the indie films.
Oh,
we have two very good indie films to review first. Yeah. We're going to do The Reaper Man, which I reviewed for the site recently, and was directed by Jaron Lockridge, starring Jessica Jai Johnson, Keenan Walker, and Ebony Bivins.
You don't have to face anything alone till death do us part. Really, death ain't even that strong.
You have an aura of deep sorrow surrounding you. You're a widow. Do you believe in the supernatural? Evil.
I see evil every day. But if you're talking about demons and ghosts, I can't say I do.
Undo whatever it is that you've done.
What is there to undo?
Okay, he's come back, but he's killing people. I need you to stop it and make him go away.
You saw this one, Brian?
I did, yeah.
Yeah. Indie horror film, got a lot of throwbacks, I think, to some of the sort of classic movies of scares and jump scares and things like that.
Yeah.
Very indie feel to it. It's got kind of, I would say, quite a low budget. Before I get to my review, what do you think, Brian? You go for it.
I really enjoyed it. I really liked it a lot. As we've discussed previously, I'm not a huge fan of horror as a genre. You know, I don't respond in the right way. You know, we've chatted about this before, haven't we? But yeah. I don't react in the right way to a horror film. So for me to enjoy a horror film, it has to be something unusual and something different. And I really reacted to this in the right way. I found it quite scary and quite gripping. I like the idea of a fusion in storylines in some ways, because this is basically a zombie killer, isn't it? Come back to hunt down those that have wronged him. And I like that idea because it incorporates ideas from Death Wish as well. You know, this idea of vengeance, vigilantism, up to a point. And for a low budget movie, I think it was highly effective. And some really good lines, because I think the essence of horror is that they do bring out humorous elements in the story. You know, and there were some great lines, because he was hunting down members of this gang that robbed him and his wife.
Yeah.
And you know, the tagline, "Time to Atone." You can imagine that being a tagline on a hit movie, couldn't you, really? And when one of the gang members tries to shoot him, and Joseph says, "I've got no more blood to spill, but you have." I like that line. It's such a good line. So I found it very enjoyable. What about you?
Yeah, I'm the same. I think I found it. It had a strong setup. You know, the idea of the couple, they get burgled and it kind of goes wrong, and Joseph ends up getting killed, and the wife's sort of distraught in the fallout of this and ends up turning to like a local, I don't know what you'd call her.
Voodoo
practitioner.
Voodoo?
Is that the category on Google? Dark magic. Yeah. So
yeah,
and you know, offers to help the wife, and lo and behold, does warn her. Just want to say that, you know, she does warn her that when he comes back, he's not going to be the same, and clearly he's not. He's hell-bent on revenge and is looking to get these thieves to atone. And he shouts that line, I think, at all of them, doesn't he? Like, time to atone or whatever, or something like that. Like, when he does slowly find them. That's what he does. And I think what I like about that is that it's the horror. It feels like a classic horror setup, and they've stuck to it, and they've really felt that they're going to deliver it with timing. It's got it's like nice timing to it. Yeah. Sometimes with horror films, there's an essence of keep moving, keep running, keep everyone screaming. But with The Reaper Man, it was like it had a slower pace to it that felt that they were actually letting the movie breathe a little bit, and you had time to kind of care about the characters. Some scenes did actually go on a bit too long, if I'm honest. It was a bit like, you could cut there if you wanted to.
Yeah.
But but generally it was nice to see the film, you know, tell this story in a way that felt they had the space to do so. And you end up really, really, really caring about the wife who's, you know, part Jessica, who's partner has absolutely left her completely devoid, and now is causing trouble. That it's like she's stuck and she's caused it. You do kind of wonder who you're meant to root for. I'm guessing it is her, because she kind of brought it on herself, really.
Yeah, she kind of did, didn't she? Really, I suppose, really. But that came out, you know, any grieving widow might go to a medium or a psychic and say, "Bring my husband back." And that's something real. That's kind of like a natural human emotion. But of course, she wanted him back as he was, and not how he actually was, you know, became. But I really liked it. It's an indication of how much I rated it, because I'm not a huge fan of horror movies. So I naturally set the bar quite high, but I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, it's quite accessible, I think. It's not trying to scare you every 2 seconds as well. That I like that. And there's like a very human plot there alongside this zombie style story. Is he a zombie though? I guess he is a zombie back from the dead. But
I was thinking about that when I was watching it, because is it really a zombie or an apparition or
a demon? Because he comes back. Yeah, I mean, I'm not great on the terminology, but
no, nor me.
But he is coming back to reap hell on these people, and that's absolutely what he's, the Reaper Man.
That's what he says in the tin.
Good performances as well. Yep. I like the chemistry between a lot of them, especially because what was good as well, they were giving you flashbacks to the couple like throughout the film, so you saw when they got married and things like that. That added a nice depth to the story, because it was like, oh wow, like you're understanding more of their trajectory as a couple and what they've gone through and how they got to where they were. Some of the sort of revelations later on are actually more powerful, because you get that depth, which they could have not had. That they could have just had the guy running around killing everyone, but actually you learn to like know more about him. That I think that was important to do that.
There's a discernible narrative there, isn't there? That the fact that it began with them as a couple, you know, personification of domestic bliss, and they're getting the money together for a house, you know, and then it suddenly jumps, doesn't it? Jumps to this level of extreme violence and the fallout from that violent act. So I like that kind of jump between two extremes. So, but it makes the story more human. And as you point out, a lot of horror movies just overlook a strong narrative or a narrative that holds together, but this does. So that's in its favour as well.
There we go. That's The Reaper Man, directed by Jaron Lockridge. And it's currently available on VOD and demand. You'll have to do a quick search. I'm sure you'll find it pretty quickly. If not, ping us an email and I'm sure we can direct you. Next up, second indie film of the episode, Fear, directed and written by Rocky Palladino. Interesting one, this one. This one was it was reviewed on the website a long time ago, and we were asked to review it for the podcast, and I thought, okay, I'll have a look at this. And I really liked it. I thought it was a very interesting film. I've not seen something like this delivered, especially not by a UK team, in terms of the combination of almost like a Taken style thriller of trying to find your loved one, mixed with like a musical approach. I know this sounds baffling, but it does make sense in the film. Am I crazy? That is right, though, isn't it?
The way I took it was that Fia, played by Sharika Sherard, she plays a busker, aspiring singer-songwriter who's on the cusp of signing a record contract. She has a partner, Justine, who suddenly walks out on her. And she goes off to find her, but it leads her into a very dark world, doesn't it? And there is that strong suggestion of human trafficking and sex workers, and it's a very unsavory environment. But it surprised me, really, because, you know, when you're kind of watching something and you're writing the story yourself, and you think, I know what's going to happen next. But it surprises you, because I thought when Justine walked out on her, I thought she was just going to write a new album of songs based on the breakup.
Yeah, I did too.
Were you thinking that?
I thought it was going to be, all right, yeah, she's going to spiral into depression now.
Yeah.
And we're going to see her struggle, throw away her opportunity and yeah, come full circle at the end,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
But then it doesn't go that way at all.
No, I know. But yeah, I think that is really what it boils down to. But it surprises you as a viewer. It's not what you expect. But that's so much more to its credit. I think Sharika Sherard has got a good voice, and there are all her own songs that she's written there. And I was really impressed with that. But if I'm really honest, I found myself wanting more of her songs.
Yeah.
She sang maybe three or four throughout the 87 minutes-ish that it was on. But apparently the director, though, saw her busking in the street, and she'd never acted previously. And you wouldn't think it, would you, that she'd never acted?
I thought it was a good performance. There were times where I do think she struggled with the emotion of it. I have to hold my hands up there and not be honest. Yeah. And I don't want to spoil the story, because there's bits where I'm referring to that would give it away what happens. But there are certain bits where I was like, you know what, that is probably just a little above the level of what you can handle, because she was with another character who's a sex worker who was very good. She did handle it really well, and it was a very good performance. And I think when you put the two together, and this happens a lot in cinema where you get musicians that turn themselves into actors. I mean, you mentioned David Bowie earlier in the episode. But when you sometimes get these performers that are fabulous, obviously, you know, what they do, and then they turn into acting, and that when you ask them to deliver something like that, it is really difficult. And not being funny, it's a difficult scene, what I'm referring to. It's by the bus. It's by the bus. I don't want to say anymore. But it was like, that was a couple of bits like that where I was like, okay, but in general, for the majority of the film, no, fabulous performance. And like you say, the actual vocal performances, I because I'm a musician, I was watching it, I was like, I just want to watch more of this. I'd have a whole show of this, you know.
Absolutely.
That wasn't to detract from the great story and acting, because I wanted to give a shout out to Andrew Whipp, who plays Uncle, a bit of a baddie.
He's good.
His performance was excellent. Yeah. Really terrifying, really menacing, really believable as well. Because in a story like this, where you do have, you know, she goes into the depths of sex workers and trafficking and stuff, that you're like, this could really not work. It did it on a stage that kind of did. It was like, okay, actually, they're keeping this in the realms of believability and keeping everyone kind of focused on a narrative that would work. And there was times I was just gripped by it. I really was enthralled by, like, okay, what's happened to her girlfriend? You know, we want to know what's going on there, and what are they going to do to Fia, who's just stepped into here, clearly not a world that she's comfortable in. There was just bits where, a couple of times where I thought they vamped it up so high that I just don't think she could quite crush it like she does the vocal stuff.
I think it's interesting with performers, singers, pop stars, people that are performing artists. They write songs and they sing. You naturally think they're going to be born actors, and it doesn't necessarily follow. I think you know, it's not always going to be the case, because you know, when they get up and perform, sing a song, there's an element of performance there, and acting is about delivering a performance. So there are similarities, but you know, I sense that she's a work in progress, and that, yeah, there were points in the film where it was kind of getting away from her a little bit, I think, but it was a good first, you know, good first shot.
It's a fabulous. Yeah. You telling me the story about, you know, she's not even like professionally trained as an actor. Yeah. I think that's incredible. That's remarkable. Yeah. But yeah, there was just those slight bits. But I think in this role, you'd be very hard, strong to find someone that could do all of it, you know, could do all the vocal stuff, could do all the performance. Yeah. She's playing the guitar literally in front of us. Yeah. And I think, you know, it's the type of film that it's inspiring in loads of different ways. I think it was made during the lockdown. That aspect.
Yeah.
You've got the protagonist, who's a singer-songwriter, black female, who becomes almost a bit of an action kind of hero, sort of. It's got a lot of originality about it, a lot of things that I've not seen on screen, definitely not enough anyway. Yeah. And also it's tying into this. I didn't know about this story until I knew, I researched it about this film, but Orpheus, you know, this story about
legend of a
person who plays music and stuff, that I was like, okay, actually there's some real depth here. There's a lot of thought that have gone into this film, and a lot of fabulous production values. I thought it was, I don't know, I think more people need to watch it. I genuinely was like, I watched it, I thought, this is exactly why we do what we do. Some people need to go and literally rent this film right now.
Yeah, I think both indie films that we've reviewed on this particular podcast, Chris, are excellent. Two of the best indie films I've seen in quite some time. And you don't realise the standard and the quality that's out there. And it does need, I mean, a film like Fear does need a platform. You know, it does need to be seen by a much wider audience. And it'd be a crying shame that if it didn't, it didn't sort of develop from here, that it didn't lead to something else, because it needs to be seen by a much wider audience, which is what we often say with indie films, that they need to be seen by more people.
Well, luckily you can, because it is available to rent and or buy on Amazon Prime, I believe.
Let me
double check. Yeah, it should be in the UK and the US. If it's not and you can't find it, do drop us a message and we'll do our best to point you in the right direction. But I'm pretty sure I checked it out on there first.
I think it is actually.
You can certainly watch it there. And it was really worth time. Hour and a half. It's a good amount of, you know, indie film there, and yeah, something that you aren't going to see. You know, this is not going to be the sort of film that is just falling into Netflix. So yeah,
absolutely.
Check it out.
Yeah.
It's been it's spelled PHEA, by the way, Fear. If you're wondering how it's spelled. So that leaves us with only one film, and there's only really one way to introduce this film, really, which is Jaws from 1975, Steven Spielberg. I mean, can you get more cinema than this? This is just cinema, isn't it? Is this cinema?
Yeah, of course it is. Absolutely. In every sense of the word. The fact that it's nearly 50 years old doesn't diminish its power in any way. No way whatsoever. I've seen Jaws. I've seen this film a few times over the years, but I hadn't seen it. When you said we were going to do Jaws, that was the first time I'd seen it in maybe 10 or 12 years. And I was kind of testing myself a little bit. And One of the tests that I apply to this film is, are the special effects still holding up after nearly 50 years? And I think mostly they are. You know, Bruce the Mechanical Shark did a fantastic job. even though it kept on breaking down. And there's an interesting story behind that, which we'll come to a bit later. But I think you really see what a brilliant filmmaker Steven Spielberg is with Jaws, because this mechanical shark, by modern standards, would look primitive. But I think Spielberg realised at the time that to leave it on screen for too long, the subterfuge wouldn't last. So he kept footage of the mechanical shark down to a minimum and mixed it with real-life footage of a shark. So it felt real, but you only got brief glimpses, and that heightened the tension. Brilliant piece of filmmaking. Really good. And three brilliant actors.
Yeah, you can't go wrong with this film. I've seen a few people that have only come to it later in life. Yeah. I watched it probably a bit too young. I think I watched it when I was like about 8 or something. When my brother, I think, put it on. It's a very suspenseful film, but as a child, I did not find it that scary, if I'm honest, because I think as a child, it was like, yeah, it's fine. But because I think as a kid, it's more like if you're watching things that are more, I don't know, human based, because like, I think that would be more scary. But with Jaws, it absolutely holds up. There are obviously, if you know the stories, I know a few things about the sort of the shark and stuff that it's like, they are a bit clunky if you're really looking for them.
Yeah.
But if you're not, I still think it really holds up. There's the bit where he goes in the cage in the water.
Yeah.
I'm absolutely terrified of open water. That for me is like my biggest fear.
I know.
And when he goes into there and all you can see in front of him is the bars and then the just the expanse of blue.
Yeah.
And then it slowly gets slightly more darker towards him. I'm like,
I know.
That is pure fear that I'm feeling right now.
I know. It's absolutely brilliant. I mean, and what a great tagline, you know, just when you thought it was safe to go back in the water. You know, I was about 10 when Jaws came out. So obviously I didn't go along and see the film at the cinema. The only films I saw at the cinema then were probably James Bond and Star Wars and Walt Disney, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
So I only got to see Jaws when it was released on TV. And back then, the film companies had the whip hand. They would only allow a film to be shown on TV 4 years after release. So I didn't see it probably until the early 80s. But it had an incredible impact on me when I saw it. I thought it was amazing. Particularly those three actors, Roy Scheider, Robert Shaw, Richard Dreyfuss. I saw a play a couple of years back called The Shark is Broken. And it was a play written by Ian Shaw, who is Robert Shaw's son. And he played his father in the play. And it delves into the tension that grew between the three actors whilst they were waiting for the shark to be repaired. Bruce the shark kept on breaking down. So the friction you saw on screen came from something that was real. Because they'd spent days together sitting on this boat, three egos together, waiting for this shark to be repaired. And what you see, the tension you see on screen, came from something that was quite real because they were getting on each other's nerves. And I think it's fascinating to see what made it the film it was. Not only did you have three brilliant actors, you had a brilliant director and a great screenplay by Peter Benchley, but you also had real-life tension being played out on screen.
It's a fabulous film, and it really worked in terms of the pacing of it. Like I mentioned earlier about a film, that they give you enough to make you kind of, oh, this is interesting. Oh, this is, oh, what's going to happen? What's going to happen?
Yeah.
But they don't overdo it. They don't over-deliver the shark, and they don't give you sort of so much that you kind of go, oh, okay, right, yeah, that makes sense. Like if you've watched some other of these sort of films, like Sharknado or those sort of things, they just blow their load so quickly that you're like, oh, right, yeah, we're all done now. But with Jaws, it's just a great example of how you can coax a story into the perfect running time that you are, by the end of it, the last half an hour is sensational. It is so gripping and so moving. And it's an amazing film. Amazing.
But there's some really clever touches there that really shows what a genius Steven Spielberg is. You know, when Roy Scheider, because he plays the police chief, doesn't he?
Yeah.
And when he's sitting on the beach and he's convinced that there's something out there, right? And, you know, the mayor is saying, forget it, this is a big time for the island. It's the 4th of July, all the rest of it. When he sees something happening, they go for an extreme close-up very quickly on Roy Scheider. He's got great expressive eyes, and that look of fear is palpable. You can feel it. You can see he's terrified, absolutely terrified. And I love those sort of touches. You know, for example, when they're hunting the shark, they've got these kind of yellow boys, haven't they, that are attached to a kind of a harpoon. And when they know they've got the shark, they can see these two yellow boys moving along. That is incredibly suspenseful. But you don't see the shark. He leaves it in your head, doesn't he, Spielberg?
Yeah.
And that is genius. Absolutely genius.
One thing I noticed as well when I was watching it was the script. Quite often the characters are talking over each other. And I loved that. It had a really natural dialogue to it that it also really vamped up the tension because it was chaotic and no one knew quite what was going on. Yeah. And it really like added to the feel of that. I only noticed it on the most recent watch, but yeah, it was just something I picked up.
I know that you're right. And I think it adds to the realism because people in that situation aren't necessarily going to wait for the other person to finish talking. They are going to be talking over each other. That's a sense of panic setting in. So again, you're right. I never thought of that until you mentioned it, but you're quite right. They do that. And the tendency is to let one character finish what they're saying first. And that's not the way people behave, is it?
Well, it is on this podcast. You know, we wait. You know,
of course we do. Yeah, we're very polite, aren't we?
Very
yeah.
polite.
Yeah.
but yeah, if you haven't seen Jaws, it's on Netflix. So do go watch it. It's one of those films that, you know, when I was at uni, I did this thing where I watched 50 films that everyone talked about that I'd never seen. And Jaws was one of them. Now, this was, sorry, Jaws wasn't one of them, but Jaws was the sort of film that would be on those kind of lists.
On that list.
I'd seen it, but there was a lot of people that hadn't. And when I watched it for this podcast, I was like, yeah, it still holds up. It's one of those films that will be a classic because it just still really works.
Yeah.
Do go watch it. I think it's fabulous.
It's got to watch it. I mean, for any film fan, it, as you just mentioned, it's got to be on your list of classic films to watch at some point.
Did they make more? They did, didn't they?
They did. They did, I think, two or three more, but they were nowhere near as good, though.
Yeah, I haven't seen any of those. So
yeah, you're not missing much, really. Something you might want to hunt out for a rainy Sunday afternoon. But that'd be it. But no, they weren't great, to be honest. They weren't good.
Well, I'll leave them where they are. I'll leave them unfound.
For at least for the time being.
I watch all the other films in the world. Once I watch all the other films, I'll come back and grab them. Right. That was our nostalgia pick and also the end of the episode. It's been a fabulous time. We've been all over. We've been to Barcelona.
Yeah.
We've been to wherever Mission Impossible goes, which is everywhere, I guess.
Yeah, Middle East.
We are waiting for Bird Box Birmingham, though. I think that is the biggest takeaway from the episode.
It kind of works, doesn't it, really?
Really looking forward to that.
You're not convinced by Bird Box Bournemouth, though, no?
I love Bournemouth. I love it as a place, but I don't think it would be as gripping as the end of the world in Birmingham.
I think that is
going to be a film I need to see.
Yeah, I think so. I think you're right, actually. It shades it, doesn't it, really?
Thank you to the filmmakers who submitted their films, and thank you to everyone for listening. Thank you to Brian for going and seeing so many films, you lovely man. Thank you very
much. Absolute pleasure, as always.
And this has been UK Film Club, as part of the UK Film Review podcast. Do listen to our other shows and our other episodes. It's all available for you to gorge on right now. Thank you again, and we'll see you next time.
Bye for now.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.